This episode is sponsored by FreshBooks. Go to freshbooks.com/TDI for your free 30-day trial.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The government is shut down. For now, bulls continue to maintain control. It's a light week for economic data, and our guest, Jeff Small, the author of Turning Financial Planning Right Side Up. All this and much more on episode number 544 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hey there. Welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. This is Andrew Horowitz, your host, and thanks for joining me today. We are now approaching the last couple of weeks of January, the first full month of the year 2018, and it's been quite the move. I mean, we've seen stellar upside action on markets. In fact, if you would just go out and extrapolate what it would look like if we continued this pace, I think we'd be up somewhere around 125% for the year for the S&P 500. Is it possible? Anything's possible. Is it probable? Probably not. But what are we looking at here? Well, we're looking at a market that bulls maintain control in every aspect, regardless of the news, the information that's out. They're finding that there is a bright side to everything out there. And that's good, because for the most part, we know that investors really tend to gravitate towards the long side of the equation, right? Not a lot of average retail investors are really hitting the short side too hard. And that's good. I mean, this is 401ks that are really benefiting, and yours and my portfolios are benefiting. And we're seeing that corporate profitability, from a lot of different reasons and a lot of different aspects, are really doing well. The economic indicators around the world continue to stay in growth mode. A couple of hiccups here and there, some slowdown maybe in some sentiment numbers that we saw last week, and maybe we're seeing that there are areas around the world that maybe not that great. But generally speaking, if we look at it in a ratio basis, it's like 9 to 1, 9 good news items that come out to 1 maybe questionable item. And this is what is happening. This is why we're seeing that there is this, before the weekend is over on a Friday, when there is the potential for a government shutdown to really become a reality on Friday, why in fact we're seeing that the markets were bid up right until the end of the close on Friday. Because there's a lot of optimism. Investor sentiment is really good. There is a lot of FOMO going on, fear of missing out. Whereas people have, kind of tossed in the towel, sometimes called capitulation. Sometimes it's called just simply, they've had enough. But what's happening here now is that there is this idea that, hey, this is one of the best places to invest, regardless of the fact if we're seeing things like the 10-year move higher above levels that we haven't seen in some time, with the opportunity for the Fed to be raising rates. I mean, all these things that are put into the equation have been somewhat discounted. And again, this is the same thing that you'll see when you flip it upside down. When you flip it upside down, where there is selling that's going on like crazy, maybe there's a financial catastrophe, maybe there's some kind of health issue around the world, geopolitical concern, a war, when there is just this terrible sentiment, and people just say, no matter what, I don't want to be in the markets. What happens? You can't convince people to invest. You could take this down to a stock. Look at GE, what's going on there. I mean, clipped right at the 16 level on Friday, lowest in years. This is when we thought that maybe there was a chance that 2018 would be a bit of a turnaround year. They'll get rid of some of the parts of the company that are dragging them down and causing some concern, but something is going on there that is obviously not normal. It is not what investors like. And it almost reminds me of what we saw with many of these other conglomerates over the years that had something else that was really concerning, something beneath the surface that wasn't very apparent, but the stock kept on moving lower. And when it was all said and done, and there was a few of these in history, there was some off-balance sheet financing going on and companies that were set up to bring money in and push money through to make the books look better. There was valuations of loans that were really not right. There was a whole bunch of accounting scandals that went on. I am not suggesting necessarily that that's what's going on with GE. However, it sure looks and smells like something is not right. When a company like GE, we know the strength of their product line, generally speaking, is not able to capitalize on it in this kind of environment where their stock is at multi-year lows. No one really wants to invest. They have a decent dividend that, you know, obviously is possibly going to be at risk. But however, still, we're talking about significant drawdown on a name that was supposed to be one of the blue chips of the blue chips, GE. A lot of people behind it looking at these things as, undervalued and really people are missing out on something. But meanwhile, again, the stock continues to go down. So investors want to stay away. Sentiment is negative. So again, this opposite end of the spectrum when it comes to investing. And oftentimes, you'll get sentiment that goes absolutely haywire to the extremes in either direction on whether it's a stock or whether it's a index or some other instrument. People get really excited, get emotional. Once that happens and once we start seeing that, that's when the red flags are raised. When things are so bad and you see that there's a massive volume day spiking down, maybe 5 or 10 times the volume on a stock and the stock is just selling off like crazy, maybe that's the time to start thinking about, at least if nothing else, dipping into something and then possibly adding on to it because maybe all the sellers have disappeared. Same thing on the upside. We've seen this before where you see this blow off top concept come in. We talked about this on DH Unplugged last week where you see a stock move up and ramp through an all-time high and just go vertical. And then during the day sometime, it turns lower and you see that maybe all of the buyers have exhausted their opportunities. There's just nothing left. And now what happens? Now those that got in at the high start to sell and those that get in the lower start to sell and it starts this cascading effect and a reversal effect. So it happens on both sides of the markets for a variety of different reasons. So we're going to keep a watch out that because right now we're seeing some technical indicators that really are, I got to tell you, at the extremes that I've seen them in years, if not some of them historically. One of the things that we look at every once in a while when we get these kind of conditions that come into play is the Spearman indicator. It's a statistical calculation and goes through a variety of different machinations to come up with where these levels are. And when it gets above like 95 or so, you start to wonder what's happening there. And more importantly, when it starts to start rolling over after being that high, you wonder, is this going to be at least a short-term setup for a little bit of a kick down in the markets? And when it gets below a certain level as well, same thing. You know, it's this oscillator that happens. Traditionally used a zero line, but when I look at this and I see what I'm seeing right now, and historically when you look back and the same exact pattern emerges, I start to get a little bit worried that things are a little bit overdone. Now, in this market condition, people ask me, well, what do you do? Well, you definitely don't go out and just go crazy with the shorts until you get multiple confirmations, because we've seen time in and time out where markets come down and come in a little bit, they just ramp right back up. Not only do they ramp right back up, but they come back with a vengeance. Last week, we saw a 260-point day on the Dow Jones Industrial Average just evaporate towards the end of the day, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed below where it opened. It closed negative. Meanwhile, fast forward just a day, And I guess there was a desire to just get back in and make sure that we made that daily move up. It was up 300 points the next day. So you got to be really careful with this because there are traps being built and you got these algorithms playing out, the high frequency traders that are doing their thing. And right now, what I would say to you is that if you'd like to lighten up a little bit, okay, fine. However, again, until we see sentiment change dramatically, until we see that the buys aren't bought with such a vengeance, until we see multiple confirmations, well, all things are still green. There has to be a change in something in order to necessitate a change in your investment strategy, whatever that is. And right now, I still don't see a lot of that, you know, because we are seeing the continuation of growth. Are we going to go into a recession right away? Well, I don't think so. Are we going to all of a sudden have earnings fall off a cliff? Well, there's no indication of that. As a matter of fact, we're seeing that earnings are earnings growth is expanding. Margins are expanding. We saw the tax bill helping out a lot. We see that optimism is up. We see that there's a great amount of central bank priming going on around the world. So therefore, I mean, again, you know, we could take the contrarian side of this right now, but I'm not exactly sure where that's going to get us. When it's time, when you start adding up all the components that go into this, all right, then is the time. All right, just want to mention a couple things before we get to our guest today. I don't know about you, but I'm getting a little bit, well, I'm done, fed up, tired of the whole political ranting from both sides and every side going on. You know, it got to a point where I'm starting to see on social media and also in the media, in the regular media, you know how there's certain stations that are either left or right and hardcore and all they do is complain about this or they defend that. And I started to see this leaking over into social media and it started to really compound. And I saw this on a regular, you know, minute by minute basis everywhere. There was people getting crazy. They were, you know, moving in so hard in one direction and holding on to their particular views and getting nasty. And it started really getting to me. I started thinking, how do I feel about this? And I started to get kind of down on this. Started to get a little anxious from it all because it was really getting overwhelming in my opinion. And I felt that, you know, I was no longer able to say anything without, and even if it wasn't politically motivated, people would kind of come back with some weird commentaries. You know what I did? Couple of things. First, I stopped following a lot of the people that have an absolute hardcore obsession with one side or the other. They don't let anything in. Whereas every single thing they post or write about or talk about is just one-sided only. And I started watching and seeing less of the various stations, like you look at CNN on one side and Fox on the other side. And I'm like, you know what? I'm not watching these guys anymore. Let me kind of, you know, look at a Bloomberg, just look at the business news portion of it as best as possible. So less political media I took in and I, hey, life is better. I feel a lot better. I feel like, you know, a cloud has been lifted because it's been so divisive and it's been so argumentative and so nasty. So I don't know about if you're having that, if you feel that is, you know, infiltrating your life and your mind, you got to be clear. And then this whole political circus that's going on is not very, you know, it's not helping anybody's sanity. Let's put it that way. You know what? Let's take a moment now and talk about our good friends over at FreshBooks. Because if you haven't checked out FreshBooks, this is pretty cool stuff. This is a you know, if you're an individual who you're working for yourself or maybe in a small company, and you know there's a lot of things that go into the daily grind of what you're doing, right? And, you know, you look at some of the things that are going on and you say, well, you know, things have changed over time. Technology has really helped me out a lot. But what am I doing about really giving myself a streamlined approach to how I'm actually operating in terms of invoicing, in terms of billing, in terms of, you know, making sure that my time management's there and looking at all that. And FreshBooks, what they did recently, by the way, with their new version, where they really went in and spent a lot of time looking how businesses work and looking to redesign in a way that fits a business's needs is pretty cool. I spent some time on looking at all this and making sure that it really worked nicely. You could generate invoice with tracking. You have notes and reminders and client information there. And you can actually get a 30-day free trial, which I really encourage you to do, over at freshbooks.com/TDI. freshbooks.com/TDI. You can do things like estimates on projects and project management, and you can look at profit and loss reports, and it's all cloud-based. It's very easy to use. There's a lot of templates that are available for you, and it's done such a way that from what I went through in terms of, you know, if you were setting up the business to working on the ease of setting up like credit card processing or just simply tracking of time, really intuitive, really easy to use. So definitely go check it out, freshbooks.com/TDI. And make sure if in the how to hear about us section, you put in there thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Now, a couple of things before we get to our guest today. I'll mention that, hey, thanks so much for all of the book recommendations. I had asked last week for that. If you want to continue providing me some really good books that you have, some things that may have been life-changing in the world of investing or maybe even in the world of finance, generally speaking, just go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and click on the Ask Andrew and just pop it in there. I want to hear what you have to say. And like I said, we'll kind of get maybe a little book club thing going on here. But I wanted to also talk about the economics that are due for next week, because we have some. It starts really on Wednesday. Monday, Tuesday are nothing. But we have things like coming up on Wednesday, the mortgage purchasing index. Okay, that's all right. We have the existing home sales index, which is important for markets. And expectations are for about 5.7 million on a run rate, a little bit lower than last period. This has been a pretty good and a pretty consistent level that we've seen for some time. And we know that when we look at things like the Case-Shiller numbers in the 20 city, we're seeing that housing prices are holding up really well. Now, there's areas of pockets that aren't, but generally speaking, when we average it all out, looking pretty good. On Thursday, we have initial claims, continuing claims, new home sales coming out, another important number for markets to take a look at as they've been really working up pretty high. Last time we saw about a 733,000 run rate, and they're expecting a little bit of a drop down when you look at the average analyst estimates, about 679. Got leading indicators, which not that important. But on Friday, we do have some important things. We got GDP advanced for the next quarter four. And this has a pretty important impact, looking for about 3%. We saw about 3.2% in the last quarter. We also have durable goods orders, which should be, I would think, you know, you would think they should be pretty good with the fact that, you know, there's a lot of good news in the housing area. We see the dollar coming down substantially. You know, we've been seeing some decent numbers in the durable goods. If you look at the headline number last period, it was 1.3%, expecting about a 0.6. Now, the one problem with durable goods is a pretty choppy number. So you got to look at a much more of a longer term here. But it is kind of a high level and important number because it talks about some of the bigger items that are being sold. And obviously, there's a big impact on GDP and on what's going on here. We also have a lot of earnings coming out this week. Starts the kind of the big flow. So we saw the banks. We saw some of the financials come out in the last couple of weeks, and those numbers were okay. I think they were right in with investors had anticipated. There's some question about the amount of the charge they're going to take due to the tax reform, but a lot of write downs happening. Supposedly one-time write-downs. But moving forward, we're going to be seeing Netflix next week. A bunch of technology starts to take the stage. The airlines are going to be next week. And then starting at the end of the week, we start to heat up even further. And next week becomes, big tech week and a lot of other names that are really going to move markets. So far, like I said, there's still the anticipation that the tax bill is going to be really good. Question's going to be, how much of an impact, if any, does this government shutdown, if it lasts much longer, have? Historically, it's only been really important to markets if it's lasted a really long time. A couple of days, nobody cares about. A couple of weeks, people start getting nervous. We already see the dollar has been diving, and it consistently keeps on getting lower recently, even though we see good economics and a lot of good things here in the U.S., but you can probably chalk that up to two things. One, probably there's something to do with concern about some of the geopolitical stuff that's going on. You could also say that in a way that's good because the dollar is usually used as a safe haven trade. And if they're moving away from the dollar, where are they going? Well, they could be going to emerging markets, or areas that are more aggressive. And therefore, that can be seen as actually a very positive for the global environment and for sentiment. Once we see that dollar start climbing, if it does, because maybe there's some concern or fear out there for some reason, that's all of a sudden going to turn things around. But right now, this tailwind that is created, particularly for the multinationals, is a pretty good thing. So keep that in mind. So we talked about some of the, after we talk with our guest, I have a question I want to answer. There's a few questions that came in last week. I answered a bunch of them through the email. You can go over to Ask Andrew on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And do me a favor. Don't feel shy. Don't feel worried. Don't feel concerned. No questions too small. Send the question in. We'll get it on the air. Or I'll send you an email back on it. But there's one question I wanted to kind of get to, because I think a lot of people have the same issue about pre-markets and post-markets. But we'll get to that in a second. But let's get right to this week's guest. And our guest today is Jeffrey Small. He's a certified investment advisor, and he's author of the book, Turning Financial Planning Right Side Up. So, Jeffrey, how are you?
Hey, it's great to be here, Andrew. I'm great. How are you?
Good, thanks. Hey, I want to talk to you about a couple of things. I went through your book, went through your bio and all that, and you have some interesting things in here. So I guess the first question I just got to ask is, why did you write the book?
Well, you know, the book really is a 33-year brain dump, Andrew. And the reality of the book is it teaches investments for folks who are looking to master the inside game of Wall Street, avoid the media bias, and look for somebody in the inside of the industry who's going to give them insight that they don't necessarily have or have have access to.
So, you know, in the book, there's a lot of different areas in the book. There's a couple of themes I thought that I picked up here. And I kind of wanted you to go through some of them and in no particular order here. But for example, you talk about, and you have a variety of items discussing, you know, get out of stocks. So kind of give me a little bit of an insight. I mean, if this is obviously from 20 years, you're not talking about 20 years ago. You're talking about kind of now. I mean, get out of stocks, right?
Well, sure. Let me quantify that. So, you know, we've had this epic run in the stock market. The Dow and the S&P are both up over 315%. Markets just don't keep going up at some point. But the market has been tenderized or peppered for growth by very low interest rates, next to nothing, actually, and lots of corporate stock buybacks. And a lot of the things investment folks out there and people that investors don't understand is how much activity is really truly institutional, how much is truly corporate stock buybacks, how much of it is individual investors. And about 40% of all stock activity for the last 8 years, purchases that is, has been corporate stock buybacks. And they've done exactly to the stock market, exactly to the stock market, what they did to real estate back in 2002 to 2007, when one of our pets could have gotten a mortgage with just stated income and a social security number. So they've flooded the capital markets with leverage. And companies are issuing bonds to buy back their own stocks. They're using their capital cash cushions to buy back more stocks. And they've cushioned the market. And so it's hard to tell today what is true froth and what is true valuation. And since we've had the tax cuts in December, the market is further peppered to increase in value because now the metrics of the market look better. Price to earnings have dropped because profit margins have gone up. The bottom lines have gone up. So the market looks even healthier than it did before. So it's all kind of like a pseudo market. So it's hard to tell today what's true froth, what's true valuation. But when we get into the math and we deal with somebody who's over 55, if they have less than $1.5 million in the market, or $1.5 million or less, $1.5 million or less in their savings, they should not have any risk right now because they can't afford to take a punch in the nose if the market drops 50%. However, if somebody has $3 million or more, can they afford to have some risk and take a punch in the nose? Sure, absolutely. So I'm not a perma bear, so to speak. So I think it applies individually to everybody's own situation, which is original and unique based on their financial size and shape.
You know, it's interesting because if you think about the most recent financial collapse and what happened there and how that was, how different people dealt with it. So who do you have? You have, well, maybe young people who had money in the markets, maybe their 401ks, maybe, you know, all that. And okay, so that's one set, right? And they take this hit. They're not necessarily going to change anything around and they have a lot more years to recover. You have somebody at the opposite end of the spectrum, which is just about to start to retire, right? Take no further income from their job. And now all they have is their money from, you know, savings. And a lot of that may have been in stocks. Well, that's what you're talking about, right? Because those people don't have the opportunity to, and the time period to necessarily recover. That's how you're really focusing on this, right?
Well, you're correct. It's really, the book was designed for folks that are over 50, but for folks that are under 50, you know, they need to take heed, because for the last 17 years, the S&P is only up 5% in 17 years. That's even with the 31% move we've had in the Dow under Trump. I mean, Trump's added, you know, almost $7 trillion of net worth to the market. Since he's been in office, the market's kind of gone crazy. Sentiment has gone crazy. We have aggressive behavior. And so, you know, if you want to ride up the next 20-25% uptrend in the market, that's fine. You can, because the market's going to be bullish for a little bit longer here until the Fed decides to crush the market by raising rates for the next 2 years. So the reality is, you can ride this up. And if you want to outperform the market, I will tell you, there's times to put risk on, mm-hmm. and there's times to take risk off.
So that's the first stage. You know, you talk about also, and I think in there, that there's some kind of, you know, the next potential side of this is going to be the hangover, right? The after effects. So what do you see? What do you project? I mean, what are you thinking?
Well, Andrew, the book is about showing people how to net 5%, and there's a specific chapter in there. And so our industry, unfortunately, does not teach investors, clients, consumers, how do they net 5% if we have growth plus maybe a bad year or two with some withdrawals combined for income, and additionally, what do fees impact those, the math as well. So when we look at the calculus of those things, we discover that one bad market year can ruin the party for folks, whether you're taking money out of your portfolio or not. So the goal is to make sure you've got a life preserver to buoy your assets so you always net 5%. And so, you know, again, to use the same parallel, we've only averaged 5% over the last 17 years since 2000. So we want to avoid the next downturn, because that downturn will torpedo your net rate of return over the long term, sub 5%. And so what we do in the book is, in the Goldilocks zone, it shows folks what temperature or what financial bucket is just right. I mean, conservative bucket, our bowl of porridge, is too cold because it doesn't earn very much. The aggressive side, if you don't have enough money, is going to be too hot. But in the middle, in the Goldilocks zone, the moderate bucket, or the moderate boil of porridge, that temperature is just right for folks that want to focus on being yield-centric or income-centric. And we teach folks in the book how to purchase investments or work with their advisor that are yield-centric and fixed income-centric. And there's a number of things they can purchase that yield between 4 and 7% on an annualized basis without being market-centric.
Yeah, I get that. I totally get that. Now, let me just kind of skip to something, and I want to come back, okay?
Sure.
I want to skip, or maybe move back, in something you talk about in the book. And one of the things you do is you kind of, maybe tell me how you feel about this, but it seems you come pretty hard after the traditional design of markets. And particularly, you kind of go after, you know, the high fee structures, and, you know, the markets are rigged, and that, you know, you have all these bad actors involved in the markets and all that. You talk about, you know, hey, you know what, these guys charging, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5%, whatever it is, they're looking to do this while, you know, your firm only charges, you know, let's say 1%. But I mean, that's kind of changed over the years, hasn't it? I mean, haven't fees come down significantly across the board?
Well, fees have come down, but when you've got, like, I'll use an example. We'll talk about, you know, Ken Fisher. He's the guy that advertises on TV. He's very bullish.
Yep.
I just took over a very large portfolio for him. It was a $2 million portfolio. He had them 70% in stocks, 30% in mutual funds. By the time we calculated what their actual expense was, they were about 1.8%. Now, that's pretty high for a guy that claims to be feeless on TV, as one example. And so same thing happens at other firms like Wells Fargo. I see about the same range at Fidelity as well. And so the bigger firms are still kind of hammering out the fees because that's their model. Their model is fee-based, diversification, be bullish, don't worry about the volatility. It's acceptable to accept risk. And it's not acceptable if money is finite, or you're not saving anymore, and you need to live on the income of that asset. And so that's not acceptable. So, but again, you know, the market will be bullish for a little while longer here before it turns.
So but if you have a, let's say, you know, the examples you just gave about, you know, Ken Fisher or whoever it is, you know, whatever the structure is, and let's just, whatever the percent exactly is, you've calculated that the management fee and the fund fee and the underlying ETF fees, I mean, that gives you diversification utilizing some of that. So what is the alternative? I mean, if you have, let's say, we're going to exclude advisor fees for a second here, okay? What are the investments that you can have then that, you know, it'd have to be like individual investments, such as individual stocks, for example, so you don't pay a mutual fund fee. Maybe you'll have individual bonds, so you don't pay an ETF or a mutual fund fee as well. Is that what you're saying? Kind of go after the individual rather than the package product?
Well, absolutely. You're much better off purchasing individual components in your portfolio if you're looking to avoid fees and harvest a much higher yield or rate of return from a fixed income standpoint. And so that's exactly what the book promotes. On page 121 in the Goldilocks zone, we talk about what individual components are there that investors can buy today, either by themselves or with an advisor, to marshal a higher yield that might not be market-centric. And two examples, of course, would be corporate bonds, which there's a shortage of right now. Everybody wants them. They're very hard to come by. The market's been illiquid for the last 3 years, but we still get our fair share. And then there's also hybrid securities, hybrid preferred securities like preferred stocks. You know, Bank of America is one example. They've got a par value at $25. A preferred security works a lot like a bond. It has very less similarities. One has a dividend, one has a yield, but it has a maturity, has a face value. And basically, I guess Bank of America right now is paying 6.5% on their par value, but it's closer to 6 based on the current stock price. So that's a good yield from a Warren Buffett type company.
But the problem is that with preferreds, and I want to get into this discussion, and you talk a little bit about preferreds a few different times, and you give some examples of preferreds, why they're better than stocks, where they have a dividend that could be higher, and there's some voting rights to them and versus common maybe, or, you know, depending on what the structure is. And you talk about that, you know, that preferreds will give dividends, and if they pause the dividend for some reason, that what happens next? Where's the benefit there, you know, in the future?
Well, there's preferreds that can be called, but there's so many good preferreds out there with Warren Buffett type companies. I mean, Citigroup has one. Morgan Stanley has one. Bank of America has one. All of the best preferreds are in the financial and banking insurance sector. And there's a number of great companies out there that you had no idea were paying, you know, between 5% and 7% as a dividend. And it's phenomenal. So if one got called, it's really no big deal. And I'll give you an example. In November of 15, we were holding JP Morgan preferreds. They were paying 6.12% at par on interest. And basically what happened was they had a bad quarter. They lost $500 million. They laid off 2,100 people. So we're like, you know what? The preferred stock price didn't change at all, but we don't need to hold this company. And so we dumped it and bought the next company up. And so there's plenty of other companies to digress to if one is called or if somebody has a bad quarter. And so you want to really filter out the corporate risk if you can. You don't want to hold a company if they're having a bad quarter because there's too many other diamonds to buy, Andrew.
The only problem I find with preferreds is I've lived through several different preferred debacles. And you never know where this is going to happen. They're much less liquid than common for the most part. They have, you know, you can have base preferreds, you can have cumulative preferreds, and obviously depending on how they're structured, you can get a payback of dividend if they're halted or paused for some period of time and withdrawn, and then you can possibly get them on a cumulative basis. You'll get them in the future. Sometimes on a non-cum, you won't get them. The problem is I've seen these things go down 50 and 60%, just like stocks have. And particularly if you're dealing with the financial markets and you're dealing with financial stocks, those stocks that, you know, took the biggest hit that will have, and we have seen, core corrections in over time, they kind of, you know, when you're starting to deal with these and trying to pick individual ones in a portfolio, it gets me a little nervous.
Well, it's good to have diversity.
They're mostly in financials.
You are correct about the systemic event that happened back in 08. You know, preferreds got hammered because the entire financial industry was on the brink of collapse. And so barring a systemic event, preferreds are generally considered uncorrelated, non-volatile components. It doesn't mean they can't drop. What it means is if the market goes up, they're not going to go up in market value. But if the market drops substantially, the preferred has a chance of being income-centric and not dropping or pacing down with the market. It doesn't mean that there aren't other risks to preferreds. You're exactly right. And so barring a systemic event, they're going to be much safer than a common stock would.
But at the same time, you're kind of talking about how there's going to be potentially some systemic risk because of all the things that have happened here. When the Fed pulls a punch bowl, there's going to be a major problem. And I can't reconcile the two, especially because, again, I think that preferreds are much less they have less liquidity in them, and the potential for a preferred to be priced as a bond to a degree as interest rates go up. And if we see interest rates going higher when a preferred has a fixed interest rate, could also see degradation of the principal value. Now, these are perpetual. These are perpetual, usually preferreds. It's not like a bond that at the end of the period, they'll give you back your money. It's not like a 20-year bond where you buy a bond. It doesn't matter what happens. Interest rates, I'm getting my 5%. I'm fine. And then at the end, I get my money back. And in a preferred, though, they're perpetual. So therefore, the price can vary dependent on what the relationship is with interest rates, right?
Oh, there's no doubt. And you know, what we've seen on an annualized basis is a 10% swing in share price in preferreds as money ebbs and flows out of that marketplace. And you're exactly right about the liquidity, too. That's one of the downstrokes to a preferred, is that it doesn't necessarily have the liquidity and the volume on a daily basis that a traditional common stock would have for the same company. So it can make it illiquid if a lot of people head for the front door at the same time. And so you've got to be very careful about what you purchase. You know, it depends upon what your objective is. Of course, preferreds are not a panacea, but it presents a healthy alternative to, you know, being bullish and just kind of riding the range of the market, or what I would call the roller coaster at this point, because we seem to be at the top of the roller coaster.
The other thing is, and let me just kind of switch over to commodities for a second here. One of the things you said is, I think, if I can quote you on this, it was something about commodities. I'm not going to quote you. I'll just paraphrase. How's that? Commodities, get the hell out. You know, don't be involved in commodities. Too risky. Something about that, right? Here it is. Commodities, meanwhile, are ultra volatile. And unless you're dealing with any other real estate besides your home, you should probably avoid them as well. So, you know, it's interesting because my work has shown me that in a diversified approach, if you'd actually add commodities to a portfolio, I'm not talking about a large amount, let's just call it, I don't know, 5%. It seems to actually tamp down overall volatility, because dependent on the market cycle, you're going to see some opportunity in commodities during maybe adverse circumstances or vice versa. And it seems to actually tamp down overall risk of a portfolio. Do you disagree with that?
Well, it depends on what cycle you're in. And so I think there's merit to both of our arguments, Andrew, but I think that it depends on what cycle and how you want to modernize somebody's portfolio to reflect the current state of the markets. And so, you know, when stock markets have a tendency to peak, commodities have a tendency to rise. And, you know, if you're in commodities right now, it's probably not a bad thing. But when the stock market decides to bottom, is it going to be a good thing to be in commodities? Probably not. Mm-hmm. And so there's merit to both. But, you know, back in the 80s and the 90s, we were in commodities because that was the old, you know, let's do this and for an inflation hedge and, you know, make sure it kind of balances out the market. We'll put 7-8% in somebody's portfolio. And maybe we had one good year out of each 10 years during those decades where commodities did really good, until they kind of went crazy the last 17 years with all these stock market peaks and valleys. So I think you've got to coordinate that with how to be modernizing your perspective and your philosophies on money. I don't think it should be a blank check methodology stick the money in there.
Right. So. No, I get that. I just, it seems that certain asset classes, when you mix them right to a degree and you kind of do some look backs, not optimization, but look backs, it seems to somehow give a little bit more of a smoother return over time. I'm not talking about 1 year, 2 years. I'm talking about, you know, over a 10-year cycle that, you know, you add, for example, you know, real estate, for example, to a portfolio. Well, that would not have been good in 2007, 8, 9, right? I mean, that'd been bad, real bad.
Correct.
But real estate, generally speaking, you know, and you talk about REITs in here, you know, they have a good yield, and they have, you know, over time, depending on, again, market cycle, they seem to be a good alternative to just investing in equities. And, you know, they kind of give you a little bit of a cushion in certain environments. Same thing, like I said, with commodities. You also talk about annuities. You know, it's interesting because we talk about annuities every once in a while. And as a matter of fact, in the book that I wrote, I have a whole chapter on annuities. And it's interesting because, you know, the cycle where we are right now, one of the things that you talk about in the book is that there's just no money in things like short-term government paper and, for example, CDs and money markets. There's nothing there, right? But yet annuities are kind of at the bottom also of the cycle in their interest rate environment. Plus, they're a little bit of a different animal. How do you deal with that?
Well, the fixed annuity market, that's CD lookalike annuities, really are dead because the rates are awful. I mean, you can get 3.25% over 5 years, but nobody wants to lock up their money. And folks in our industry don't really feel like working with those types of rates of return. They can get that somewhere else in a shorter term basis. And so those are dead. And then there's variable annuities, which, you know, variable annuities are quite expensive, high fees. You know, we see about a 2.5% to 3% charge on average. If they've got a rider, the charges can exceed 3.5%. And that those are really not very good products. And then there's the fixed index annuities. And so there's about 630 of those. Most of those are fictional or what we call monopoly money based, where they've got a pseudo income rider that might roll up at 6 or 7%. If you turn that rider on, well, guess what? They're paying you back with your own money. And it's an actuarial game that the insurance company seems to play. There are a couple of good fixed index annuities, though, that are more appreciation centric, that give you the largest share of the market growth out of the group. And for folks that want their money to grow because they want to see their account balance move and not have it based on some type of monopoly money or fictional sense of compounding, they're better off to focus on that. Now, in a bull cycle, variable annuities can be good because no one's going to complain about those because when the market goes up, guess what? They're going up. Mm-hmm. But if the market goes down with fees, it's quite the hammering. If they're withdrawing money while the market goes down with fees, it's quite the hammering. And so I think what the book is designed to do, Andrew, is show people what the costs are, how to measure those costs so they can make a determination for themselves as to what the best option is for them. So, and so there is no one size fits all. Everybody has to look at their own situation.
Yeah, I just want to get back to something because this is something that you talked about that's really kind of important and overlooked quite often by people. And it's something that's really not talked about. It's sold more than it is bought. It is pushed more than it is desired. And that is, at least this is what I'm saying, in my opinion. It's exactly what you talked about, which is these we'll call these guaranteed income riders, or there's different names that they call them. Whereas you have an annuity of some sort, and maybe it has exposure to the markets, and then you tack on this other deal that says, hey, you know what? Here's the deal. You have $100,000 you invested. Hey, you get all the upside and the downside of the market. However, in the future, you could decide if you want to lock in a value, whether it's the current $100,000 you put in or maybe a higher watermark that the account hit at any given time, because now all of a sudden it's down to $90,000 or $80,000, we are going to guarantee that at least a 5% increase in your rate of return on an annual basis. And if you want that, you just say the word. And if you do that, then we'll just pay you out over time, over your lifetime, an annual amount, whatever it is, that is based on the value. Now, you know what I'm talking about, right?
Sure.
Yeah. Bad news, right?
It's really bad news. And so what happens, Andrew, is somebody comes into my office and they're like, Jeffrey, I've got this great annuity. It's paying me 7%. And I say, no, it's not. You think it's paying you 7%, but it really isn't. But no, the guy that sold it to me said it's paying 7%. And they always use the word sold. They never use the word bought, just like you said. Mm-hmm. And so when I show them what the 7% does, yeah, okay, the account will double in a little bit over 10 years. However, you can't walk away with this money. It's not really tangible. You can't access it. The only way you can access it is if you turn on an income based on your life expectancy. And so what ends up happening is I say, okay, they're going to give you this income based on this inflated compounded number at 7%. But guess what? They're paying it from your account value. You're paying yourself back with your own money. The insurance company isn't doing that for you. You're paying for it yourself. Thereby, you're cannibalizing the asset. And we talk a lot about cannibalization in the book and how to avoid that strategy to create income. And so the reality is it's an actuarial game that the insurance company makes, that your annuity account won't go to zero until you're in your middle 80s or later. And by then, they don't have to write a check until then, and most people are dead by then is what ends up happening. So they get off the hook scot-free.
And the other thing is that's really important is that throughout the life span of this annuity, before you get to the point before you take the money out, that particular benefit costs you, I'm picking a number, 1 to 1.5% a year.
It's a little bit less than 1% as an average, but we'll say we'll round up to 1% when we look at those products and we analyze them. Now that we've beaten the snot out of them, Andrew, I'll tell you that if somebody has very limited assets, okay, those products can have some merit to create guaranteed income that they may be income focused. And so, but if you've got a $1 million portfolio and you're going to take a half that and put it into these fixed annuities that have these pseudo income riders, this fictional element of growth that you're never going to be able to take with you, it's a complete actuarial joke. It's a used car sales tactic. Do not utilize them.
Yeah. I mean, like you say, listen, there's in every product line, whether it's a mutual fund, whether it's ETF, whether it's stock, whether it's preferred, there's good and there's bad, right? You just got to, the problem is finding the good and the bad, because there are some index annuities that I actually think have some merit. Like you said, you know, there are some variable annuities that may meet a particular need for a particular client at a particular time in a particular circumstance, right? I mean, but the problem is that, as you had mentioned, and I said too, when they're being sold and crammed down someone's throat and, you know, explained with a, you know, a very slick presentation rather than fitted into a plan that is based on the client's need rather than the commission need of the insurance dude. I mean, that's the whole point of where the differences lie. That's at least my thought.
Well, no, you're correct. And so advisors fall into a trap where they recommend the same product for everybody over and over and over and over. And this trap is what I call the annuity trap. And so they sell the same annuity product over and over and over, but one size should not fit all. Some folks might be appreciation centric. Some folks might have a need for guaranteed income. And so as consumers, I had designed the book to give them insight so they could understand the difference. And so that's the important part. But you're right. There can be merit in everything, but there's got to be something specifically tailored to your own situation.
Yep, I got it. Jeffrey Small, author of Turning Financial Planning Right Side Up. I'm sure you can get this book in all sorts of places. We'll also put the information on how to get in touch with him, find out more about him, you know, everything about him, his bio, all that good stuff on the show notes for episode number 544 on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Jeff, hey, thanks for joining me. I appreciate it.
All right, Andrew. Great talk.
All right. Bye-bye. All right. We sparred a little bit on a couple of different items there. And, you know, I mean, that's how it goes, right? You know, some things you agree with, some things you don't. But overall, I think some good takeaways from that discussion. And like I said, we'll put his information on how to grab his book over on this episode's show notes over on The Disciplined Investor. If you haven't gone over, by the way, thedisciplinedinvestor.com, there's some cool stuff on there. All of our strategies are on there. Different ways we manage money for people, what we do. You can kind of check all those out and see what's going on there. And, you know, there's also some summaries of some of the recent podcasts in text version. And what's really cool is if you haven't done this yet, there's a really neat guest visualizer there. If you just click on the thing that says podcast on the top on the navigation bar, just go down to guest visualization. You can see in a really neat way what guests were on historically, and as their name gets bigger, they've been on more times. You click on that, shows you all the different shows they've been on. You can click on any of those and then either listen in, see what the topics were, et cetera. In addition to that, you could do a search. You could search on like what stocks were mentioned on any show and see where they were mentioned and who talked about them. And you could search on a particular guest that you have. So there's a lot of really cool things over on that site. So I encourage you to check it out and see what's going on. Before we got to the guest, I had mentioned that I wanted to bring up a question that was asked last week that I thought would be really something that probably there's some other people that have the same questions, or at least some interest. So Adam S. writes, he says, hey, pre-market, what goes on and how does a company's stock price get influenced during the pre-market and post-market? I hear sometimes that overnight a stock price increases by X percent. How? That's a good question because you think about markets, right? You got the opening bell at 9:30, you get the closing bell at 4:00, and you know that's the stock price for the day. And you look at a chart or of a daily chart, and that's the price that you see: the open, the high, the low, the close, and that's what happens during that particular time of the day. Now, pre-market. Now, there's different stocks that trade different ways, but generally speaking, the official pre-market is 8 a.m. And you may see a stock that's called and bid up. Oh, the stock is up in the pre-market. You could actually trade in the pre-market. Now, depending on where you trade, depending on where you buy and sell your stocks and things of that nature, will depend on how it's structured. So basically, if you put in an order and you say, hey, I want to buy the stock today and I want to buy at the market, for example, which is just immediately upon when you press the button, it may actually default to only a day order, which is not pre-market. There may be another button there somewhere that says, yeah, I want this to actually be live during pre and post-market. Now, the post-market goes on after 4:00. And again, depending on a few things, somewhere around 7:00 at night is when it closed down. I mean, 8:00 technically, but for some. But technically, you know, about 7:00 is where this thing trades to. Again, some stocks don't even trade in the pre or the post market because they just don't have volume or any interest. But if you have earnings that come out in the morning, a stock is going to trade. Now, volume is not necessarily there. You'll see that maybe a stock is bid up 5% on a couple thousand shares. People looking to get in early. Now, that may continue throughout the day or it may not. It may be just somebody covering a position and trying to just hit it at any price and they bid it up. Or there could be a stock that's down significantly, maybe after the market closes due to some kind of an announcement, some kind of maybe a CEO leaving or change or, again, earnings or a sector-wide issue, a drug failure in the, for a biotech. It could be 100 different things. Or it could be even, you know, an analyst downgrade or upgrade. So what happens in the aftermarket doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be that way the next day. We've seen several times stocks come down on earnings in the post-market. The next day, they're bid up throughout the pre-market, and then by the time the market opens, it's up. So you can actually trade with a lower amount of liquidity in those markets. You have to identify it on your trading platform that you're actually trading in the pre- and post-market, that you want your order to be live. Most of the time, they don't allow market orders. You have to do a limit in the pre- and post-market trading. And just be aware that while there are the opportunities to make significant amounts of money in the pre and post, that liquidity is down. So what that means is you're going to see prices extending probably outside the range and a greater degree of volatility. So just consider that. So again, you have the day markets, the normal operating hours, which is 9 to 4. Sometimes you may wake up in the middle of the night and look and you see, well, it's 4:30 or 5 in the morning and I see that there's a couple thousand shares traded. I don't know how that happens because, the traditional markets, you'll even see 7 o'clock trading happening. You can depending on which platform you trade on, which custodian, which broker you use, it depends on what their numbers are, what their times are in terms of the pre- and post-market. But generally speaking, you start to get the volume, especially if there's news, at about 8 a.m., give or take. And then it heats up throughout the day if the news is really substantial. And then after the market closes, you get the same. Up until 6 or 7 o'clock at night is where the volume will continue, probably 4 to 5:30. If there's something significant going on, then it tapers off. So just be careful because the spreads are usually wider in the pre- and post markets because there's a lot less liquidity, a lot more less players out there. And just be careful when you're trading there because it could be a real problem. Anyway, Adam, thanks for that question. Of course, you could ask any questions you want. Also, you know how to get there already. If you haven't heard me say it once, heard me say it 1,000 times what to do. So I'm not going to tell you again. Of course, I want you to do me one favor. Listen to DH Unplugged this week. Coming up on Tuesday evening, myself and John C. Dvorak talk about all things about business, some of the lighter side of business, some of the more serious stuff. We try to deconstruct some of the things that go on there and what's happening. Make sure to do me another favor. You can tell your friends, your family, just send them a link. You can also sign up for daily updates on the Disciplined Investor, the site. There's a couple of places to do that. This way you get the information. Of course, follow me on Twitter, at Andrew Horowitz. That's my Twitter handle, Andrew Horowitz. You'll get immediate updates of when podcasts are out, news items are sent. As well as during the week, I put up charts and I put up some commentary on Twitter. It's a pretty easy way to do it. Instead of writing, 500 word or 1,000 word blog post, it's become the better way. You just do it all in 280. It's all we can handle anyway. Most people only read the headlines, it seems anyway. So why not just wrap everything into just an elongated headline? That's going to do it for today. So have a great weekend. I'll see you again next week.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.